Good afternoon, and welcome to Reminiscing, a program of nostalgia and recollections of the good old days, times that we remember as happy and maybe a little simpler. We know we can't go back, but we can certainly reminisce. This is your volunteer reader, Mary Ellen Stepanek, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, your 24-hour reading station. And welcome to November. Here is the letter from the editor of the November-December issue of the Good Old Days magazine. It's entitled, Trimming the Tree, Planning the Meal, and Other Special Holiday Memories. It's hard to believe the holiday season is now upon us. Time certainly flies at this point in the year. Maybe it's all the preparation for big family gatherings, the enticing thoughts of holiday goodies, or the anticipation of what might be under the tree. Everyone has such wonderful memories of holidays past, and we're delighted to bring you many of those in this issue of Good Old Days. As you look through the stories, you'll be transported back to when kids spent hours poring over the Sears wish book and when families planned out multi-generational dinners. Turn each page to find stories of visiting relatives, setting up the Christmas tree, spying at the decorated department store windows, all the holiday memories you love. In our Good Old Days in the Kitchen feature, Jennifer shares some of her Christmas tales as well as five delicious recipes. The cute green and white crocheted elf gift set mug warmer and hot pad would be fun projects to crochet this year. You can find the patterns in Holly Jolly Crochet Christmas, available at anniesattic.com. Although the last 2 months of the year often revolve around other holidays, November is also the time to observe Veterans Day. So in this issue, we also share a few memories from those who have served. We hope you enjoy this issue of Good Old Days and that it transports you back to another time. And most of all, we hope it stirs up wonderful memories from your own past. Happy Holidays from the Good Old Days staff. Here's a special feature in each issue of the Good Old Days magazine. It's called The Good Old Days on the Radio. And this item is entitled Gangbusters. Real-life law enforcement on the radio sends a message, crime does not pay. This article was written by Carl Amari. In the fight against the mob during the 1930s and 40s, radio listeners proved they could make a difference, and the Gangbusters audience helped put real criminals behind bars. In 1935, when Phillips H. Lord created Gangbusters, the crime rate was high and law enforcement was low. Crimes were highly publicized, and their perpetrators were sometimes glamorized in Hollywood movies. With most radio crime programs dramatizing pulp fiction stories, Lord decided to portray the procedure and practices of real-life law enforcement officers, basing his dramas on court records and police files. And because it glorified the FBI, Gangbusters had the full support of J. Edgar Hoover, the bureau chief. Official guest speakers, including Louis J. Valentine, former commissioner of police of New York City, further enhanced the program's authenticity and credibility. At the close of each program, nationwide quote clues consisting of descriptions of suspects and contact information for the relevant police force or FBI were given out. Later, popular TV programs such as America's Most Wanted and Unsolved Mysteries would make use of this same device. By May 1942, more than 250 criminals had been apprehended as a result of the clues on gangbusters, reinforcing the series' central message, crime does not pay. In 1937, mobster Martin Durkin sought an injunction against the radio program, proclaiming they had no right to profit from his crimes. A judge ruled against him. Before long, gangbusters became a national sensation, with Shirley Temple and Babe Ruth ardent fans of the program. Universal Studios released a cliffhanger serial adapted from one of the episodes, and DC Comics produced a series of comic books based on the radio program. In 1952, NBC premiered a television series of the same name that alternated with Dragnet on a weekly basis. Despite its higher ratings, Gangbusters was dropped in favor of Dragnet. Now here's a note from the magazine. You can receive your free 30-minute classic radio episode of Gangbusters, courtesy of Good Old Days magazine, via digital download by going to www.classicradioclub.com, and that will be available until the end of this year. This next story is entitled Grandmother and Her Baby Booties. Her sweetness and crafts travel far and wide to make people happy. And this story was written and sent in by Diane Fallon. My grandmother and grandfather, Beam, were married on June 1, 1911. They owned a farm in northeastern North Dakota. They had 12 children, with one who died at birth. My grandmother Beam, who truly loved children, always said she was cheated out of her even dozen children. My grandparents brought up all 11 children on that farm. It wasn't always easy, especially through the dirty 30s. They loved the Lord, prayed, attended the old country church, and always gave thanks to God for all they had. God always provided, maybe not what they wanted, but what they needed to survive. When their four boys got old enough to take over the farm, my grandparents retired and moved to a small house in the nearby small town of Niagara, North Dakota. Just so you know, this town was named after Niagara Falls, New York. As the first settlers moved from that area after immigrating through Ellis Island and then relocating to North Dakota. My grandmother was very talented in both crocheting and knitting. She made socks, gloves, scarves, hats, beautiful doilies, and lace edgings on tablecloths, hankies, and towels. She especially loved to knit baby booties. She always had many on hand to give as presents. I loved to look at them, neatly arranged in shirt boxes, one box filled with pink, white, yellow, and peach booties created for baby girls, and another shirt box with blue, purple, and green booties that were just perfect for little boys. My grandmother not only knit booties for her many grandchildren, but for our dolls as well. My dolls from 65 plus years ago still wear booties that were made by her with love. Back in the 1950s and 60s, the local newspaper, Grand Forks Herald, included a weekly article listing all the newborn babies in the area, including the hospital where they were born, their sex, their date of birth, and their parents' names and addresses. My grandmother, with a heart for babies and children, would send a welcome baby card to each one listed in the article. She would meticulously choose a pair of her homemade booties and enclose them in the envelope with the card. Knowing my grandmother, I am sure each pair was sent off with love and a prayer that God would bless the little one who would wear those warm little booties. My grandmother received many thank you notes and cards, but there were always a few that would drive 40 or 50 miles to bring their sweet newborn baby to Niagara so my grandmother could personally see them wearing the booties she had made. My grandmother loved to visit with new parents and even hold their precious babies. I know she must have gifted hundreds of booties in her retired years. After my grandmother died in 1969, one of my oldest aunts was given charge over the old shirt boxes filled with booties. These precious booties were sparingly given out to my grandmother's many great-grandchildren, whom she would not get to meet. I know she would have loved that they received a pair of her lovely baby booties, and that thought makes me smile. Oh, how I loved my grandmother. And this was Grandmother and Her Baby Booties by Diane Fallon. Now, here are a couple of items from the Bits and Pieces section of the Good Old Days magazine. This first one is entitled Go West, Young Man, Go West. And that was sent in by Bill Ruzgis. I grew up on the south side of Chicago. In 1960, when I was 20 years old, my mom and dad moved to California. At the time, I was driving trucks for the Railway Express Agency. The relationship with my girlfriend had just broken up, and I was living in a small basement apartment. I decided it was a good time to join my parents in Los Angeles County, in the city of Bell, California. After a three-day drive, I arrived in California. I was subject to the military draft, so I enlisted in the U.S. Army Reserve for 6 months. I graduated from military police school in Fort Gordon, Georgia. I returned to California and made an application to the Orange County, California Marshals Department. It was there that I became a court bailiff and was later promoted to the field to serve warrants of arrest. I once had a warrant for an 80-year-old lady in Laguna Beach for messing with trash cans. When I told her the judge wanted to see her, she took out her false teeth and said, "You can take these to the judge." Instead, I went to the courthouse to see the judge and had the warrant of arrest recalled. When I retired from the Marshals Department, my wife and I were able to travel to different places throughout the world. Time marches on, and since my wife passed away 2 years ago, I'm now living my life in moderation. This was Go West, Young Man, Go West by Bill Ruzgis. This next short item is entitled Sonar Disrupts Johnny Ray. This was sent in by Robert Strange. My destroyer was in its final construction phase at a Seattle commercial shipyard prior to acceptance by the Navy. It had been an unduly lengthy shipbuilding process during the Vietnam War era, with ensuing delays caused by an extended shipyard strike. We were now nearing completion, with overtime authorized to expedite completion. Testing and certification of the ship's combat systems were being conducted around the clock, which included SQS-26 sonar in all of its modes. There was a nightclub directly across Elliott Bay from the shipyard that brought in top-level entertainers. One such performer was Johnny Ray, who wore hearing aids during his show. He was performing at the club one evening when the sonar certification tests were being conducted. Whenever the sonar pinged, it resonated across the bay into the club's air conditioning cooling ducts near the water, adversely affecting Johnny's hearing aids. It was so annoying that they had to stop the show, much to the dismay of his adoring fans. Upon investigation, the shipyard was found to be at fault, and with the threat of a lawsuit, they were directed to immediately resolve the matter. It was determined that the best way to solve the problem was to quench the sonar beam with an air curtain screen. A form of weighted sprinkler hose was embedded in the bottom of the bay in front of the ship's bow and was attached to an air compressor. This worked to everyone's satisfaction, including local fishermen, who found the air screen also attracted steelhead salmon. This item was Sonar Disrupts Johnny Ray by Robert Strange. This next story is entitled Creative with Crepe. No matter the holiday, this family was ready with special decorations and costumes. This was sent in by Arlene Chauvald. Crepe paper provided solutions to a lot of decorating and dress-up problems when I was growing up in the 1940s and 50s in Iron River in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Halloween and Christmas are the two events I remember the most. When I was 7 or 8 years old, I'd start preparing for Halloween in July. Seriously. My friends and I would plan our costumes and our trick-or-treat route, somehow always forgetting that by October 31st, the weather would be cold, and the best costume choice probably would be to dress as an Eskimo. It seemed like forever before Mom hauled out our Halloween decorations in mid-October. A lot of them were made of crepe paper and tissue paper. Skeletons had legs and arms of accordion pleated tissue paper, and witches' skirts were the same. Packages of black and orange crepe paper came in folded sheets like gift wrap. We cut the sheets into strips that we twisted into streamers and then draped from the chandelier in the center of the living room to the walls where it was taped in place. Always thrifty, Mom sometimes managed to salvage some of the streamers from the previous year. But there was always a need to go downtown to the J.J. Newbery store and pick up some new packages of crepe paper. At the same time, we got to check out the new masks. Masks in those days were made of what seemed to be starched cheesecloth. After wearing them for a few hours, they got soggy around the nose and mouth, so every year we got a new one. Our costumes were usually made from old clothes. I do remember a few times when we ordered costumes from the Sears catalog. One year it was a clown for me and a skeleton for my little brother, Larry. Other times we made costumes from crepe paper. One I remember was a mummy costume made of white crepe paper. That didn't work out so well when it snowed on Halloween. To add a spooky touch to the house, we wrapped our lampshades in black or orange crepe paper. Halloween wasn't the only occasion for crepe paper creations. At Christmas, it was the same, except that the colors were red and green. 4th of July meant a parade, and kids would decorate bicycles, tricycles, and doll buggies in red, white, and blue crepe paper. Even the adults got into the spirit, decorating cars with crepe paper. Cardboard boxes took on a new life in February, decorated festively in red, white, and pink crepe paper for classroom Valentine boxes. In later years, the Iron River High School homecoming parade called for decorating floats in school colors of red and white. I don't see many crepe paper decorations anymore, but I certainly have a lot of wonderful memories about the stuff. And this was Creative with Crepe by Arlene Schovald. Now here's a story entitled Granny's Patchwork Quilts. She took scraps and created works of art. This was sent in by Linda Vandiver. When school was out for the summer, I would spend a week with my grandmother, Wivel Rideout, who lived in Sturgis, Kentucky. My family and I lived in Madisonville in western Kentucky, about 40 miles from Sturgis. One summer visit was in 1956, when I was 8 years old. I loved going to Granny Rideout's house, which was just outside town. She cooked on a wood stove, had a fireplace in each room, and drew water from the well in the backyard. I would sleep on a soft, downy feather bed. There was also a half-moon house behind her garden. To me, this was adventure living. But one of the things I liked most for that week was helping Granny with her quilt pieces. After breakfast and the morning chores, which was gathering the eggs from her few chickens, feeding the cat, picking vegetables from the garden for that evening supper, and replenishing wood in the wood box. Well, then she would bring her wicker laundry basket onto the shaded back porch. She would sit in her chair, and we'd go through the basket of discarded shirts, blouses, dresses, aprons, pillowcases, and sheets, some of which neighbors and friends had given her. From these, she would cut her quilt pieces. But first, she would take the shirts, snip off the buttons, and then drop them into her button jar. Next, she'd cut off the collars and cuffs, saying, "I'll sew these together to make hot pads." Then she'd remove the long sleeves, which she would later tear into strips to plait and make rag rugs. From the backs and fronts of the shirts and blouses, she would cut the quilt pieces. She would use the remaining scrap pieces of material to stuff pillows. Granny never wasted anything. Most of the pillowcases were prints or had borders, and she would cut shapes from them, too. She had paper patterns for her quilt pieces, stars, circles, diamonds, different size squares, bow ties, and Dutch dolls, which she had cut from grocery bags made of heavy brown paper. Using the patterns, she would cut the fabric pieces, and then I would stick the colorful same-shaped ones on long safety pins to keep them together. After cutting a while, she would unfold the quilt top she'd been working on, and I'd give her the pieces she asked for. Granny sewed everything by hand, using the tiniest, even stitches you ever saw. When she was finished sewing for the morning, we'd go to the kitchen for a cold lunch. After lunch, I'd ask her to show me the quilts she had finished. We'd go to the big cedar chest in her bedroom, and she'd bring out several quilts, laying them on the bed for me to see. Each one was a work of art. She made quilts not only for her own use, but to give to newlyweds and family members, and to give as housewarming gifts. After supper, with twilight approaching, we'd sit on the porch again, counting stars in the darkening sky and eating cookies warm from the oven. Soon it would be time for bed, and she would let me choose the quilt I wanted to sleep under. It was heavenly to snuggle down in that soft feather bed, with night-cooled air coming in from the slightly open window, wrapped in a warm quilt made by my granny's own hands. And this was Granny's Patchwork Quilts by Linda Vandiver. I almost felt the tears starting as I was reading that story, because I remember the last time I visited my mother before she died. We were looking at the quilts that she had made that she still had in the closet in her sewing room. And needless to say, I have quilts that my mother made on every bed in my house. And I think of her every time I make the bed. And that concludes our program. You've been listening to Reminiscing on Sun Sounds of Arizona, Arizona's 24-hour reading station. This is your volunteer reader, Dr. Mary Ellen Stepanek, wishing you good afternoon and good memories.